Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is somewhat a pogo stick potpourri, which in a very real sense reflects the current schizoid schism of our daily bedlam of Babel. I begin with a response to the nomination of a candidate to the U.S. Supreme Court of an anti-abortion judge. I wrote it and have rewritten it, and I call it A New Civil War? Probably unconscious of the ramifications of his words, a man who claimed leadership of the anti-abortion crusades at abortion clinics compared the U.S. Supreme Court decision that transferred the right of abortion to the state to the Dred Scott decision of 1857. He said that the high court's ruling to gut but preserve the skeleton of the 1973 abortion law, Roe versus Wade, was comparable to Dred Scott, which was a major factor that precipitated the Civil War. Scott was a black slave who sued the Supreme Court for his freedom. Slave owners and their political and judicial cronies insisted the court reject Scott's claim of citizenship because he was a slave, which meant he was hardly human. Abolitionists, on the other hand, attempted to convince the court that all persons were human beings and entitled to full citizenship and freedom. Chief Justice Roger Taney declared that the original intent of the Constitution favored only the freedom and citizenship of white men. The general consensus among the founding fathers and long afterward, Taney said, was that Negroes were, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights that a white man was bound to respect, unquote. The net effect of the Dred Scott decision was to make the issue of slavery too explosive for political or judicial settlement. It was later termed a monumental indiscretion and a public calamity, both of which are quotes. Justice Felix Frankfurter once remarked that Supreme Court justices never mentioned Dred Scott after the Civil War, any more, he said, than a family whose son had been hanged mention ropes or scaffolds. The same unfortunate premise has dogged the Supreme Court since Roe versus Wade. The struggle over abortion is elemental to women's rights. Abortion opponents more or less make the claim that women are not full citizens and do not have the right to make personal choices about abortion. The hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of millennia. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be the instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum of irresponsible men. Abortion at least allows women to dispose of an unwanted child before it is born. For some oppositional intent of presumed male dominance, men who abdicate their responsibility for birth control yet believe they should control a woman's options, which has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining male supremacy over women. Women are not allowed to be free and equal citizens or even given respect as parallel humanity. For that matter, more than a century and a half after emancipation, neither are black people who wish to be known as Afro-Americans in recognition of their long presence in this hemisphere. Humanity is crowding itself off its home planet. Abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of the earth by an overabundant species that seldom practices adequate birth control. In the bad old days, children were abandoned or slaughtered when a population overran its resources. Abortion and abortificants are more preferable options than infanticide or epidemics in stabilizing population growth. Yet, as with slavery, abortion causes furious arguments and is such a roiling emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is in the process of eruption. Nothing has been settled by the Supreme Court, which has enraged both sides, so-called pro-life and pro-choice. The court erroneously made a political decision rather than an impartial, constitutionally rooted judgment, and has ultimately satisfied no one. Like the three-fifths compromise that allowed much but no more, that much, I want to do that paragraph again. Like the three-fifths compromise that allowed that much but no more consideration of a slave being human, the Supreme Court presumably declares that women are, quote, so far inferior that they have no rights a man is bound to respect. And that was something I wrote and actually revised from the North Coast Times Eagle, July 1992. Now, from security website, Helsinki Summit, A Time for Choosing, Three Observations by a Former CIA Officer. And it's by Rolf Mowat Larsen, who is a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. In his stops in Brussels, London, and Helsinki, President Donald Trump demonstrated that he is as much an advocate for Russia's interests than if he were indeed recruited by Russian intelligence and formally responding to Russian tasking. In fact, his handlers would probably exercise a greater degree of subtlety and discretion to ensure he did not go too far in revealing himself as an agent for Russian policies and interests. If there is a silver lining in this disastrous trip, surely NATO, as well as leaders in Germany and the United Kingdom, must now realize that they cannot trust what the U.S. president says, appears to do, or promises. This lesson will be useful for our allies in forging a more independent pathway moving forward until this American nightmare is over. But Trump did go too far in revealing his true colors. The U.S. intelligence community can no longer trust the president's judgment after he clearly sided with Russia in the Mueller investigation and the underlying intelligence information that formed the basis of the indictments of 12 Russian military intelligence officers. If I were still an active CIA officer at the senior leadership level, I would seriously have to consider resigning on principle, rather than serve positions that our president has espoused at the side of the Russian president. For the already diminishing number of diehard advocates of efforts to improve the U.S.-Russia relationship, the summit was a death blow. History has proven that U.S.-Russian relations must be based on a position of mutual strength, not weakness. Courageous advocates of giving Putin and Russia a chance in spite of all the incidents of naked aggression have been exposed as naive, if not downright irresponsible. The purpose of pursuing channels of communications and high-level contacts will be seriously questioned by this summit, and justifiably so. For what purpose would Americans reach out to Russia in a bid to increase trust, as President Putin underscored in his summit statement, when our own president is either delusional or willing to accept attacks on the United States and on the very institutions of Western democracy, even when practiced in an acute form? Which raises the final, most worrisome observation. Donald Trump said what he said in Helsinki because he believes it. Our own president believes in the zeitgeist of the 21st century autocrat, the leader who controls events and is able to crush all barriers to absolute rule. Trump respects the strong, the unbridled leader who, through the force of personality and a position of strength, are able to bully and silence their critics. Free press, fake news. Rule of law, what's the law? Pardon militiamen and rule of law crushing sheriffs instead. Civil rights and civil liberties gone too far and needs a correction. For Donald Trump, the core values of American democracy are to overcome, not to respect and defend. This is a time for choosing. government officials, senior and junior alike, take an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States, not to obey any single president. The calculus of whether to resign or stay must be based on whether one is able to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States from within or from without. Serving the interests of this president is not serving the country. And that was by Rolf Mowat Larsen. And now, something all Oregonians should be concerned about. Lawmakers, lobbyists, and the Trump administration joined forces to overhaul the Endangered Species Act. This is by Coral Davenport and Lisa Friedman, who wrote this for the New York Times, somewhat redacted by myself. The Endangered Species Act, which for 45 years has safeguarded fragile wildlife while blocking ranching, logging, and oil drilling on protected habitats, is coming under attack from lawmakers, the White House, and industry on a scale not seen in decades, driven partly by fears that the Republicans will lose ground in November's midterm elections. In the past 2 weeks, more than two dozen pieces of legislation, policy initiatives, and amendments designed to weaken the law have been either introduced or voted on in Congress or proposed by the Trump administration. The actions included a bill to strip protections from the gray wolf in Wyoming and along the western Great Lakes, a plan to keep the sage grouse, a chicken-sized bird that inhabits millions of oil-rich acres in the West, from being listed as endangered for the next decade, and a measure to remove from the endangered list the American burying beetle, an orange-flecked insect that has long been the bane of oil companies that would like to drill on the land where it lives. It's probably the best chance that we have had in 25 years to actually make any substantial changes, said Richard Pombo, a former congressman from California who more than a decade ago led an attempt to rethink the act and is now a lobbyist whose clients include mining and water management companies. He and others argue that the act has become skewed toward restricting economic development and Americans' livelihoods rather than protecting threatened animals. The new push to undo the wildlife protection law comes as Republicans control the White House and both chambers of Congress, and is led by a president who has made deregulation, the loosening of not only environmental protections, but banking rules, car fuel efficiency standards, and fair housing enforcement, a centerpiece of his administration. The Trump administration unveiled its main effort to overhaul the Endangered Species Act last Thursday, when the Interior Department and the Commerce Department proposed fundamental changes to the law. Those include a provision that for the first time could allow the economic consequences of protecting plants or animals to be considered when deciding whether or not they face extinction. If the proposal is finalized, species that remain on the endangered list would still see their habitats protected, but it would become more difficult to list a new species for protection and easier to remove those now on the list. If the myriad proposals reflect a wish list assembled over decades by oil and gas companies, libertarians, and ranchers in western states who have long sought to overhaul the law, arguing that it represents a costly incursion of federal regulations on their land and livelihoods. Until now, those efforts have largely failed, even during periods when Republicans controlled both the White House and Congress. Advocates of the environmental law agree that the proposals signal a critical moment. The last few weeks have seen the most coordinated set of attacks on the Endangered Species Act I have faced since I got to Washington, said Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona, the ranking Democrat on the House Natural Resources Committee. This is a crucial test, he said. The Endangered Species Act was passed by Congress in 1973 and signed by President Richard Nixon at a time when using federal authority to protect threatened species was less controversial. The act has been credited with the resurgence of the American alligator, which had been hunted to near extinction for use of its skin in purses and other goods. The gray whale, depleted by commercial fishing in parts of the Pacific Ocean, and the bald eagle, which is flourishing again after nearly disappearing from much of the United States. The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service annually spends about $1.4 billion to protect threatened plants and animals, according to the agency's most recent expenditure report in 2016, an amount that environmentalists say has not kept pace with the need. But industry leaders say that money is wasted protecting species that don't need it and paying green groups litigation fees. Take the case of the northern spotted owl, which has been a rallying cry for both sides of the debate since it was listed as threatened in 1990. The logging industry has long blamed the owl habitats for a crippling decline in timber harvests, sparking a vicious battle over restricting the economies and livelihoods of local communities. But while opponents of the law cite an economic burden, there has been little comprehensive analysis of the precise economic costs or benefits of either enforcing or revising it. As to the economic benefits of preserving an endangered species, advocates for the law might describe it as a moral obligation to guard against extinction. Economists don't have the tools to put a price on these intangible values, an advocate of the Endangered Species Act said. Efforts in previous presidential administrations to weaken the Endangered Species Act were often met with some bipartisan resistance, but the profile of the Republican Party has changed since then. Over the past decade, opposition to environmental regulations has become a more ingrained part of the GOP's identity, particularly as exemplified by Trump. This is the first time that we've seen an orchestrated effort by the president, the Republican leaders in the House, the industry, and the Interior Department all working together in a concentrated effort to eviscerate the act, said Bruce Babbitt, who served as the Interior Secretary for 8 years in the Clinton administration. Opponents of the act say the current mood is simply the fruition of decades of ignored attempts to enact reasonable modifications to the law. For instance, government compensation to offset losses when landowners are unable to use portions of their property deemed critical habitat. At the same time, on Capitol Hill, the Congressional Western Caucus, a group of House lawmakers, began coordinating a strategy. On July 12th, the lawmakers unveiled a package of 9 bills that, if enacted, would see more permanent changes to the law than those pushed by previous proposals. Legislation that is passed by Congress and signed into law by the president is less easily undone than regulatory changes. While it is unclear if the lawmakers' individual bills could become law this year, they also worked to add amendments to 2 must-pass spending bills, including the National Defense Authorization Act, which specifies the annual budget for the Pentagon. The House-passed version of that spending bill includes provisions that would prohibit the Interior Department from putting 2 species of land birds, the sage grouse and the greater prairie chicken, on the endangered species list for at least 10 years. That would ensure that the habitat of those birds, encompassing millions of acres across 11 states, could remain open for oil and gas development. The Interior Department is also moving forward with a separate regulatory plan to roll back sage grouse protections. In past years, such provisions would likely have died in the Senate, chiefly because they were opposed by Senator John McCain, the Republican of Arizona. But Senator McCain today is recuperating from brain cancer and has not been active in Washington for several months. Shepherding the measure in his stead is Senator James Inhofe, the Republican of Oklahoma, who has made a signature issue of advocacy on behalf of the oil industry and denying the established science of human-caused global warming. It is expected that Senator Inhofe will champion a provision in the House defense bill that would remove endangered species protections for the American burying beetle. The insect has a protected habitat in just 4 states, but one of them is Mr. Inhofe's home state of Oklahoma. "I think the Endangered Species Act is endangered," said Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. "They haven't been able to do this for 20 years, but this looks like their one chance." Republicans also added at least 9 endangered species-related amendments to the spending bill that funds the Interior Department. Among other provisions, that bill would remove the gray wolf from the endangered species list. It would also prohibit the Interior Department from reintroducing the endangered grizzly bear into the North Cascades ecosystem of Washington State, something lawmakers from the region say could threaten the area's recreation livelihood. The Interior Department and the Department of Commerce will give the public 60 days to comment on the changes before finalizing them. That was a week ago. We only have 52 days left, counting today. And that was lawmakers, lobbyists, and the Trump administration joined forces to overhaul the Endangered Species Act by Coral Davenport and Lisa Friedman. And now, several forest fires are burning in southern Oregon. It's been estimated perhaps 100 fires in the Northwest overall. So far, one man has been killed. I wrote the following in tribute to those who have died fighting wildfires. Dying like squirrels. Norman McLean might never have realized how his posthumously published book, Young Men and Fire, would become useful and perhaps necessary to explain the deaths in early July 1994 of more than a dozen forest firefighters, which included 9 from Prineville, Oregon. McLean is more recognized by his very popular book that Robert Redford made into a movie, A River Runs Through It. He was, however, obsessed with a 1949 Montana forest fire that killed 11 smoke jumpers. He spent years researching and tramping over the killing ground of the August 10 Man Gulch fire of 69 years ago, and exhaustively interviewed to enduring friendship the survivors who escaped the terrible deaths of their comrades. McLean wrote in Young Men in Fire, "Burning to death on a mountainside is dying at least 3 times. First, considerably ahead of the fire, you reach the verge of death in your boots and your legs. Next, as you fall, you sink back in the region of strange gases and blue darts where there is no oxygen, and here you die in your lungs. Then you sink in prayer into the main fire that consumes you, and if you are Catholic, about all that remains of you is your cross." And that was McLean. The men and women who were incinerated in July 1994 while fighting a forest fire in Colorado were members of hotshot crews. Being a hotshot in the U.S. Forest Service is equivalent to the hard-ass, perpetually hard-ship military infantry. And though the media claims hotshots are elite firefighting crews, they are probably still treated like the infantry. If any possessed intelligence, none would be either, is the traditional attitude. In the past, at least, hotshots were the dogs of the Forest Service, hardly more classy than prison crews sent out to fight the same fires. Hotshots battle their enemy with hand weapons, just as dog-faced soldiers. Axes, brush hooks, Pulaskis, McLeods, and shovels, with which they chop, hack, and scrape trails through the burning wilderness. Wildfire is their enemy, inhuman in contrast to soldiers' nemesis. Sinewy, monstrous, incredibly dangerous and threatening, hot as the sun, grasping for fuel and oxygen to remain alive, sucking human lungs dry at the same instant, its intense heat evaporates blood and tissue. Which is what happened to 14 hotshots on a fire in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, working a hotline on a 2-bit tree fire that suddenly exploded into a wind-whipped inferno and trapped 50 firefighters. Most escaped, though barely. 9 of the 14 dead were from the hotshot crew based in Prineville, 5 men and 4 women. John Kelso, Bonnie Holby, and Terry Hagen from Prineville. Rob Johnson and Doug Dunbar from Redmond. Levi Brinkley from Burns. Kathy Beck from Eugene. Tammy Bickett from Powell Butte. And Scott Blecka from Clatskanie. If it is any consolation, they probably died instantly, consumed as quickly as if a bomb had fallen on them. When each flared like a match, they were already dead from the fire's lung-sucking heat bellows, dehydrated crisper than potato chips. 10 years and 5 days after the cremations of the smoke jumpers in Montana in 1949, 15 members of a luckless Southern California hotshot crew blundered into a box canyon while seeking a tactical advantage over a white wildfire. The fire caught them there, and every one of the hotshots died, though the number of dead is disputed. The 11 who died in 1949 are said to be the most deaths of a forest fire crew on a single fire until July 1994. Yet witnesses on other hotshot crews who futilely attempted to rescue the dead hotshots that summer of 1959 and instead searched for their charred remains are certain 15 died. Years later, men who failed to save the doomed hotshots claim to have heard screams from their inflamed peers. Unless a subliminal empathy of terror connected the dying with their helplessly thwarted rescuers, it was impossible to hear any noise but the roar of the fire, which could be compared with hurricane surf heard from inside a sea cave. Puny human squeals of terror would be unheard. Past and recent deaths of smoke jumpers and hotshots underscore the grim reality that fighting forest fires is incredibly dangerous and is rated the most deadly occupation of government employ, with the exception of wartime combat service. The smoke jumpers at Man Gulch died like squirrels, McLean wrote. So did the 15 hotshots in 1959 and the Pineville hotshots in 1994, and everyone else fried out of life on a wildfire. It should not end there, he said, smoke drifting away and leaving terror without consolation of explanation and controversy without lasting settlement. Probably most catastrophes end this way without an ending, the dead not even knowing how they died, but still alertly erect in fear and wonder. Those who love them forever questioning this unnecessary death, and the rest of us tiring of this inconsolable catastrophe and turning to the next one. And that was McLean. And that was something I wrote, Dying Like Squirrels. I was a member of the Dalton Hotshots, Mount Baldy District, Angeles National Forest, U.S. Forest Service, 1959 to 1961. This article appeared in the August 1994 North Coast Times Eagle. That year, Smokey Bear celebrated his 50th birthday. I was also a U.S. Marine in Vietnam, 1966-67. As a result of both experiences, I learned the difference between fighting a fire and a firefight. And as epilogue to this today's program, 2 days and 150 years ago, this coming Saturday, July 28, 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that guaranteed citizenship to African Americans was officially adopted. The 14th Amendment resolved pre-Civil War questions of Afro-American citizenship by stating, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state in which they reside, unquote. And the amendment granted all these citizens equal protection of the laws, quote unquote. Nearly a century later, the Equal Protection Clause was cited by Black activists during the civil rights struggles of the 1960s as proof that racial segregation denied Black Americans equal protection under the law. This is Michael McCusker.